Blog Talk Radio.
Lift to stay friends and welcome to the World Transform. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At the World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this astounding future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic, not to mention amazing. Happy Wednesday to you. How are you?
Yeah, it was our amazing Wednesday show. We do this every week where we like to look at things from a, put an amazing spin on everything, right? So that's
right.
Show tonight.
If we can't come up with an amazing topic, we just say amazing, you know, to remind ourselves that that's what we're supposed to be doing. But this really is. We really are on an amazing topic this week. This is part two of our attempt to answer 10 unanswerable questions from our good buddy Thomas Frey. Follow the link there in the show notes at Blog Talk Radio or worldtransform.com to get the complete list of questions and Tom's, not answers, but to talking around these questions. Because Per Tom, these are unanswerable questions. So what did we do? We set out to answer them. And how did we do on Monday, would you say? 0 for 5, would you say? Or did we somehow come up with less than 0? I'm not sure.
I would say that at the end of the show, we were in complete agreement with Tom that every question, the first 5 of his 10 questions were unanswerable.
Yep.
But I think we did break some things down a little bit, but the listeners will have to listen in and decide how well we did. I don't think we're the right people to judge how well we did there. So listen and let us know.
Sure we are. Hey, come on, who better? We are the one. But I think at best we came up with a few thoughts towards how someone smarter than us might come up with answers to these questions someday.
That's right. Here's the path super geniuses should take to answer these questions, and go this, and we try to shine a light in that direction. That's about as good as we can do.
So, and I'm sure the super genius would say, "Oh well, thank you for your help."
Thanks for your help.
Here we go.
Pat us on the head and then go off in some totally different direction.
But we must stop evaluating our performance so we can move on and evaluate and try and attempt to answer even more impenetrable, unanswerable questions. Beginning with number 6, why do humans matter? Wow. And this one gets restated as, why are humans important? So there you go, Stephen. What do you think? There's an assumption built into this one, right? Could you take the word "why" off and just ask, "Do humans matter?" Is that is that the right question to ask?
I suppose that it matters because we are humans. I mean, that's the same anthropomorphic problem we ran into several times last, on Monday's show. But I think we do matter. And let me back up just a little bit. Science has been a history of taking us out of the center of things, right? I mean, the Earth-centric view of the solar system was incorrect, and science told us that. And then, on and on, we're not at the center of things that we thought we were. And I think the last holdout in this idea, and ultimately I think we may learn that we're not the only intelligent civilization in this galaxy, for example. I mean, we're not even in the center of that. But what are we at the forefront of? Are we at the center of anything? I think that we are at the center of perhaps an intelligence explosion in the universe. And what I mean by that, we may be the tip of that spear in a way. At the very beginning of the universe, there was just, you know, the laws of the universe were laid down, bang, and that's, you know, and that, and then there was chemistry, and then, you know, and things were accomplished with chemistry, and then after that it was biology, and then brains, and then now, you know, there's networks and things like that that we brought together, and eventually AI and things like that. Well, we're at the tip of that, and so while we can't say we're at the center of the universe, we can say that we are important, because to some extent we are the universe itself, looking at itself, you know, and waking up to itself. We can say that, sort of, I guess, and we're at least part of that. So, are we important? Yeah, we are, because we're sentient, and I guess that's the best answer I can give.
Well, yeah, it's almost like, to the extent that, I mean, because it sounds really like, you know, I don't know, irritated eighth grader to respond this way, but why do humans matter? Well, why does anything matter? Have we established that anything actually matters? You know, and until you have, how can you say that? How can you say that humans have? But I think you've given as good an answer as can be given to that question, right? If anything matters at all, humans do, because I'm one. Okay, there. How's that? It kind of goes back to some of those almost solipsistic answers we were coming up with on Monday. From where I sit, humanity must matter because it produced me, and I'm asking the question. Therefore, if the question matters, and having somebody ask the question matters, humanity matters, because we're the ones asking the questions. We're as you said, we're that part of the universe that is exploring the impenetrable questions of the universe. As far as we know, we're the only part of the universe that does that. That certainly makes us unique. Does it mean we matter? Well, only if anything actually matters, which we never established. But we'll have to come back to why does anything matter, because we have another question about humans. Why are humans so fallible? Obviously, present company accepted, Stephen, but, you know.
why are we so fallible?
why are humans?
Well, you know, being humans and the fact that I think we do matter, because, you know, my actions affect other humans. And I can tell you that when other humans, and sometimes they are fallible, do things that affect me, I feel like it matters, because it either, you know, improves my situation or detracts from it, right?
Right.
So, at any rate, you know, why are we so fallible? Well, it's perhaps the, you know, we're doing the best we can, perhaps, with, you know, in growing up as a species, perhaps. I don't know. I'm not sure I 100% understand where what Thomas is trying to get at here.
Well, he says, of all species on planet Earth, humans are the least predictable, most destructive, require the longest nurturing period, and consume the most food. At the same time, we're also the most curious, most aware, most innovative, and the most likely to waste countless hours playing video games. Yes, we may have better developed brains than all the other animals, but that doesn't explain why we're so unbelievably fallible. Well, I'm not sure. I think maybe it does. Maybe we're fallible because we try to do things. You know, do other species really attempt things, right? Don't they just kind of do stuff? You know what I mean?
They tend to do what they're made to do, right?
To fail, you have to aspire,
yeah.
Right? You have to have an idea and say, I'm going to go do this, right? And presumably they do set out on their course and occasionally things don't work out. But you know, we spend our, you know, was it John Lennon said, you know, your life is what happens while you're making other plans, right? You know, we spend
right.
a lot of our time laying down strategies and saying, well, this and then this and this. It's probably the thing that has put us into the dominant position on this planet. It's probably the reason we're the big brains on the planet. But inherent in being a creature that is constantly trying to carry out some plan is the fact that, you know, your plans are going to be incomplete. Your plans are going to fly in the face of other people's plans. Your plans are going to fly in the face of you didn't understand how the world works. And so you're going to keep failing. So I think the reason we're so fallible is because we're so awesome. right?
we're out there trying to
get out there
well,
all the time.
You watch funny YouTube videos of dogs sliding across the floor or trying to walk on ice or doing things that, you know, and they obviously and you know, they have these horrendous crashes and everything, right? You know, if you call a dog to dinner and it comes across a linoleum floor and slides into the counter, do you ever get the impression that the dog has one instant of you know, feeling, I don't know, silly about it or any shame about, you know, I really don't. You know, dogs, you know, they might, if they slide into the counter and hurt themselves bad enough, they might, you know, yelp or something and not like the pain. But they don't have a sense of, you know, being brought down a notch by,
right. Right.
by their mistake or whatever. They're just, you know, happy dogs. But, you know, you see a cat, like, you know, fall or something, you get a sense that the cat's looking around like, hope no one saw that.
Right. Yeah. They have a sense of just their own,
you know, I think
dignity,
human beings
yeah.
are somewhere in between on that. You know, we do have a sense of our own fallibility, and we think about it and try not to make the same mistake more than once. You know, it's funny about dogs. You put the dog dish down, and they come running in, and they slam into the counter, and they do that day after day sometimes, you know.
That's right. It just becomes the way they do things.
Here comes the dog. He's going to slam into the counter.
He's
going to
hit the counter.
Slide
yeah.
in just because he's that happy about it being dinner time.
No, I think that's true. We try to guard against, you know, that embarrassment or that that letdown of failure, but if that sense is not so strong that we never try anything. For those people who that sense is that strong, their lives don't amount to much, right?
That's right. Again, if you're paralyzed by the fear of failure, then you will, then in a way you have already failed because
right.
well, not in a way you have because you won't ever try anything, and therefore, you know, here lies so and so that you know will be written on your tombstone, and your list of accomplishments will be zero because you tried
right.
nothing.
Okay, we got to wrap this show. I got to go do something with my life. I just feel like
exactly.
I am totally inspired by that speech.
Yeah, you need to go try something because you know exactly. You don't. You sure
yeah,
don't
make
wanna,
something happen
in,
here.
Phil does these awesome things. That's what you definitely want to have people be able to say about you.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's a built-in feature to being. To being beings that accomplish things. How about this one? Do human accomplishments have long-term meaning? And I'm going to reference a poem in answering this one because I think this is a question that was answered very cynically by the poet Percy Bysshe Shelley,
yeah.
with a poem called Ozymandias many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an even better version of this poem, by the way, by a guy named Horace Smith. And I don't know the relationship between the two, if Horace Smith wrote a response to Shelley or if Shelley was writing back to him. But they both tell the same story. I like Horace Smith's version because it carries it on into the modern day. But if you've never read the poem Ozymandias, basically there's a big leg of a statue out in the desert, just desert everywhere, just sand everywhere. There's
far
a leg.
I can see.
Yeah. There's a leg and there's an inscription. And of course, the inscription reads, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Right. And what is left
yeah.
of the, you know, to prove that Ozymandias was here, just the leg of his statue and his inscription. Everything else gone. So whoever this very big deal was, who ruled this, who knows, empire.
He'd be the guy to wear the T-shirt that says, "I'm kind of a big deal."
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter. It's all dust in the end. In the Horace Smith version, he takes it and he projects into the future of some hunter in the distant future finding some little scrap of London out in the wilderness. And wondering, well, what the heck was this? But it's long gone too. But and he's imagining his own present great city, you know, becoming a desert. That's the that's the cynical answer, right?
Yeah.
Do the accomplishments of of human beings add up to anything? Do they have any long-term meaning? And I think that if you put it back in the context that you provided earlier, Stephen, that we're the thinking creatures and that we're part of this wave of intelligence, then maybe those accomplishments go beyond the empires even that we've built in the past. But that's the only it seems to me that is, outside of religious context, that is the only long-term path for human meaning. Otherwise, everything we do is pretty much destined to become, you know, either dust or wind up in the big crunch, right?
Right. Well, I think time ultimately just renders everything we do in our lives, moot. But that does that mean that it's meaningless? Not in the context of our own lives, though. Right. And of course, we always are building on the accomplishments of people that went before, and so those the lives of people that went before and did things matter to us now. So, will the things that we do in our lives matter in 100 years? Well, probably so, because to the extent that others can build on that, the Bible talks about there being the evil that we do affects 3 generations.
Right,
but the good
right.
we do affects 7 generations, right? Which is a nice thought in a way, because we hope that the good we do has a greater impact than the evil we do. But it's but ultimately, what about the 8th generation then?
Yeah, well,
if the 8th generation doesn't really, I guess it really doesn't matter if we were good or evil, right?
Right. Even in that context, it's gone by the 8th generation, right? That's a good point.
That's right. So, you're hopeful that the good that you do perhaps touches your grandkids or your great grandkids, and then they go on to do good things that affect their grandchildren, great grandchildren, and so on and so forth. So that maybe it doesn't it doesn't play out after just 7 generations and everything's gone. The good you've done, but renders all we do kind of as a meaningless thing, but it still matters what we do within the context of our own lives, and so
yeah.
We just do the best we can with the time we have, right? So
there you go. I mean, the question was long-term meaning, and so the answer is how long is the term, and who's observing whether it's meaningful. I guess in the long run, those are the two questions that you come up against. And there's actually another question that this one raises that I'm not going to say what it is, because I'm saving that for on Friday. We're coming up with our own, and I've got one. So I've got a really good one that I think it's going to be a real stumper of an unanswerable question. So stay tuned. I bet I've got everybody wanting to tune in on Friday now. Okay, so how about this? Number 9, why is the future unknowable? And I'm gonna take a crack at this one, because it's the future. If it was knowable, in what sense would it be the future? I mean, we define the future as, and we've been talking, over these last 2 shows about, the subjective experience of time. By definition, the future is that which we have not subjectively experienced yet. And by definition, we don't know that which we have not experienced yet. Therefore, this statement is just a what's the word I'm looking for, where you just say the same thing twice, right? It's we're saying, why is the unknowable unknowable, right? Or why is the unknown unknowable? By its nature, that's what it is, right? Or is that approach too simple? What do you think?
I don't know. It reminds me of oh gosh, who was this? Was it Dick Cheney that was kind of made fun of when he was talking about known knowns and known unknowns and things like that?
No, it was the other one. I can't
remember. Oh gosh,
but not Dick Cheney. But yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it wasn't Dick Cheney. But anyway, it was after 9/11, and they were he was asked a question about how do we, proceed against this enemy? And he says, well, there are known knowns. There are things that we know that we know. There are known unknowns. There's things, that is, that's things that we know we don't know that we're going to try to find out.
Right.
And then there are unknown unknowns, things that we don't know that we don't know. And those will hit us out of the blue when they hit us. And we'll do the best we can to manage those things when they come up, right?
Yes, it was Donald Rumsfeld, by the way.
It was Rumsfeld. That's who it was. Yes. And so why is the future unknowable? I think it goes back to our chaos problem that we talked about, I believe, in the Monday show, right? There are certain rules that we can kind of follow and that we kind of know that we can kind of count on things being a certain way. The sun will rise at a certain time in the morning. I can look in an atlas and tell you the exact minute that the sun will come up in my region of the world, Phil, in a month. You know, I know
right,
that,
right.
But I have no idea what the weather will be. You know, So I guess what am I trying to say? It's just things that we do the best we can within this context. So,
you know, one of the things interesting about that is he was given such a hard time about that, but he didn't.
Yeah, he was. He was saying something that was stupid or that was impenetrable or something. It's really not.
It's exactly
the case. We have known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns, and you kind of have to break them down that way. So
yeah, all Rumsfeld was doing was he was slamming up against one of the great unanswerable questions. That's all. You know, he was walking around the edge of it. And I think you're right. I think to go back to my kind of glib answer, you can't have a future. There's no such thing as a future unless there are some known or unknown unknowns. The concept of the future is meaningless without something that's unknown. Otherwise, you're living in this kind of eternal presence. To know the future completely is to, in some sense, be out of time, to be existing not in time, right? So I think
it's sort of the God's eye view of the universe. And that's not our existence at all. So
right, yeah. And you wonder if you have that perspective, would anything even be any fun? You know, it's truly a unimaginable point of view for us. You really can't imagine it. You try to imagine, you go, well, I just don't know what that would be. I don't get it. So forget it. Let's go on. What's the purpose of death? Bummer question to end this on. When we talk to Tom, we'll suggest that he reorder these questions. Huh?
So what is the purpose of death?
Well, the religious answer, right, and the traditional feel-good answer is, you know, it's the doorway into the next thing, right? That's the purpose of death is to lead us on to the afterlife, and so all is great. And Tom hints
well,
at that,
and,
you know,
and other people and other people would say the purpose of death is to give purpose to life, right?
Yes, I've heard that too. Yes.
Yeah. And a lot of people would argue that if we were immortal and just had all the time in the world, then each day would not have value.
Yes.
The very scarcity of the days gives value to the days. Just simple economics, right? I would argue that, mean that I'm glad about the death? No. I mean, as humans, we have two basic problems, really. One is morality, and the other is death. And, we try to live the best life we can and be the best people we can. But ultimately, regardless of whether you're good or bad or whatever, you know, there's a finish line.
Right.
So I don't know. A lot of what we talk about on the show, we bring it up often is life extension. And that's one of the things that Aubrey de Grey, when we've had him on the show, has dealt with is, people that would say, well, you shouldn't do this because, if we were granted basically an indefinite lifespan, then you know that we wouldn't have you know we wouldn't and, you know have any value to our lives. Our lives would cease to have purpose. And he says, no, I don't see that at all. You know, there's things I love to do. You know, just you know if I love to get out on the River Thames and go punting, which is one thing he really loves to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you know I'm not going to cease to enjoy that today because you know I have the idea that I could do it again in 150 years, you know.
Right.
And I see where he's coming from on that. I mean, each moment is a valuable thing, regardless of whether, you know, I have the idea that I can have more moments. I don't know. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, if the purpose of death is to provide meaning to life. My response to that is, I'll tell you what, let's take it out of the picture and I'll take my chances, okay? If life suddenly becomes completely meaningless, I'll go, well, egg on my face, okay? Boy, was I
my
wrong.
My bad.
We needed death for that. And likewise, it's true. It is the door into the next thing, whatever that might be, whether it's an afterlife or it's oblivion. It is the door into that. It is the door to the next stage. And my response to that is, I want to go through a few other doors first. Thank you. To me, neither of those answers is particularly satisfactory. I'm perfectly willing to challenge either one. And I like Aubrey's answer. I also like Eliezer Yudkowsky's answer. Well, I just want to live one more day, right? I had a pretty good day today.
Yeah.
You know, give me another one like this, and that will be fine. And the idea that somehow that you're going to run out of those, right? That one day you come to the end, you know, you come to the end of the day, well, so that was a good day. I'd like one more of those, and the answer is no. That makes the whole thing meaningful. That's to me that sounds like a cop out, right? I mean, it sounds like that's the answer you come up with because you didn't have a good answer. And maybe it's wrong to challenge people on that because they do need an answer in the face of in the face of death. But
I would encourage anybody who's interested in this being, this kind of discussion, to watch A Bicentennial Man. It's an underrated science fiction movie, I believe. I don't agree necessarily with the answers that it gives, but what a beautiful movie it is. It's sad and poignant, and yeah, go watch it. If I say too much, I give too much away. So anyway, yeah, go watch that movie. I disagree with the answers it gives at the end.
But at least they have an answer. So there you go.
At least they're putting something out there. So
plus, it's based on a book by Isaac Asimov, and it's set in the Asimov Robots universe, so it's worth
That's
watching,
right.
Even for that reason.
And it's one of Robin Williams' serious roles, and he was as brilliant in his serious roles as he was in his comedic roles, and sometimes more so.
There you go. All right. Well,
so go watch Bicentennial Man for a good discussion on that.
You know what? I like the answer in general. Anyway, what's the purpose of death? Why don't you go to watch a movie? Okay, that's our answer.
And you'll enjoy it. It's a good movie.
What is the purpose of death? And with that, guess what? We've worked through the entire list. Thank you so much, Tom Frey, for giving us great topics to talk about. But we are going to come back on Friday and see if we can come up with a few of our own impenetrable, imponderable, unanswerable questions. Look forward to doing that with you, Stephen. Thank you all for being with us. And until next time, live to see it.